at a certain point, we need to be able to manipulate the microbes, either by making mutations in them or dropping them in and out of communities. And that's just not really feasible from, let's say, a whole human fecal sample. But if we can construct that in the lab and inform it based on, you know, real human data, I think that's a really exciting place to be. And I think looking forward, those sort of approaches are going to come a lot more in sort of the microbiome and the probiotics field.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today we're joined by Jordan Bezance from Penn State University. Jordan, you're very welcome, and thank you for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity. I look forward to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you as well, and particularly about an issue that I know you have a lot of interest in, and that's strains.
Mm-hmm.
Bacteria, of course, belong to taxa. They belong to species and genera and families and orders and so on. But within any given species, there can be lots of strains of a bacteria. Can you give us a working definition of what makes something a strain and what makes something else a different strain of any given taxa you want to choose?
Right. So I think the thing that fascinates me so much is, you know, we often think about things like a species, right? And anytime talking to a group of, let's say, you know, undergraduate students or the public, I always try and do a poll and I ask, okay, if I say E. coli, Is that a good bacteria or a bad bacteria? And the answer is always polarized. People either think it's always good or always bad. And I don't know if it's some sort of herd effect, but you never get a split room. It's always one way or the other. And of course, we know the answer is E. coli can be both, you know, an over-the-counter probiotic, or it can be a devastating infection. And these things are both E. coli. They're both descendant from a common ancestor thousands and thousands of years ago. But just because they're related doesn't really mean that they're the same. And I think, you know, a big component of that is this idea that the bacterial genome is quite different from a human genome. Bacteria gain and lose genes at rates faster than they mutate new genes. And so we know this definitely in the world of, you know, antibiotic resistance, but those sort of effects ripple through everything. It's just that we don't know what a lot of those genes do. And I actually originally got into this concept of strain diversity working on a project with L. rhamnosus and L. casei, which are two sort of fuzzy taxonomic group, and, you know, originally doing compared genomics on those. I think one of the things that fascinates me so much is when we're doing a lot of basic research, there's this idea of a transposon immune library, where you might want to individually knock out every possible gene in the genome. And so you'd have to screen through thousands of mutants to try and identify what gene might be responsible for it being a pathogen or a probiotic. But if you just use the natural variation that exists among all these strains, on an ideal day, you can get away with screening like 10 strains. It's nature has given us almost like a combinatorial knockout system. And this bypasses the need for genetic tools and a whole host of other approaches. And it's a much easier sell to a graduate student to go out and screen 10 organisms than it is 10,000. And so, you know, a big component of, you know, my past and current research is about how we can use that sort of natural variation as a tool. And then once we understand that variation, can that be sort of useful? And I think this sort of permeates many areas of microbiology. And I think this is one of the big challenges in metagenomics. Right? Is, you know, we talk about metagenomics as, oh, we can get the strain level resolution. And that is technically true, but it assumes that we know what the strain resolution means and what those sort of functional differences between the strains are. And that's where I feel like there's just such an untapped wealth of knowledge. If we just start deep diving on any given clade of the gut microbiome or probiotics, there's so much that we can learn. So I think it's an exciting place to be.
It's kind of terrifying at the same time, because as scientists, we need to be able to name things and describe them to one another and put labels on products like probiotics and put labels on pathogens, and so that clinicians know what they're dealing with. But if almost every bacterium is just a soup of different mutants and different strains. How do we deal with that in a practical sense?
It's such a tricky question to answer. And truthfully, I have a bit of a cognitive dissonance about it. My, shall we say, basic science mind says, you know what? We should get rid of taxonomy altogether. Every year we publish an up-to-date phylogenetic tree and every discrete clone or genome gets a unique alphanumeric identifier. And every year we publish something. But then that obviously does not fit into any sort of translational or regulatory framework. So inevitably, you sort of need to have some sort of label on these things. And so I think that's where it almost comes down to, especially when we start thinking about probiotics or clinical applications, is I think a little bit of education, right? And I think this is something ISAP has for sure been behind in the future, especially or in the past, especially with labeling and making sure that the strains are labeled. That's an important differentiation. But then how can you, educate the consumer on the important difference between Rhamnosus GG and, Rhamnosus HN001 or something along those lines. And I think part of the challenge is some of the sort of traits or, the health benefits will be generalizable across the entire species and others won't. And unless we actually test that or we try to understand the mechanisms that are behind those effects, it can be very difficult to know. And so maybe that's why, as a strategic place to be at in my career, there's a lot of growth opportunity in there, but I can see the challenges that sort of poses.
And so do you think we need almost at a subspecies level, like almost a functional annotation rather than, a number to say Lactobacillus rhamnosus, this particular isolate, let's not call it even a strain, has the following functions. Any other isolate may not have those same functions. Is that kind of where you think we're moving towards?
Yeah, I think that would be a very sort of exciting approach. You can think about E. coli as the great example. Have you ever looked up the E. coli genotypes? You can find a complete list of everything. The problem is, unless you're an E. coli geneticist, good luck at understanding those genotypes, right? So I think there's this really critical balancing act between how do you put out the information, but also have it be digestible. You can imagine something like, let's say, the U.S. Probiotics Consumer Guide, where it has very descript set of information in it. But probably as we move forward, having some sort of more functional information that goes with it will be a lot more important, especially if we start to think forward towards, say, genetically engineered strains.
We have done that to some degree with E. coli, I guess. We have, I don't know, not everyone is listening may be familiar with E. coli, but, they can be differentially described as E. hex enterohemorrhagic E. coli, E. tex enterotoxigenic, E. hex enteropathogenic, and there's about 7 or 8 of those descriptors. That kind of, they're not taxonomic terms, they're kind of functional term. So maybe that is what we need, some kind of functional descriptor to go along.
Jordan, you do a lot of interesting work trying to characterize variation between strains. And I wonder if there are within strain, and not just within strain, but even within a particular organism, longitudinally, like how do you separate functional measures and the influences on those that may have to do with genotype, but they may also have to do with all of the many other determinants between the gene and the ultimate expression.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that makes the strain concept a little bit tricky. And I think, Colin, I think I punted a question of yours earlier, which is how do you even define a strain? Because there is not, to my knowledge, one accepted definition, right? And so how many modifications do you need for it to count as a different strain? Is it 3 changes of nucleotides in 3 million? Is that sufficient to call it a different strain? Does it have to be something functional? And I think, again, if we go back to the probiotic space, something like Rhamnosus GG, like it has this mucus binding pilin that helps it, adhere to the intestinal walls. But in my recollection, that is sort of an unstable element that's been lost in some set of the progeny of the original GG. So it can be really tricky. One of the questions we sort of ask experimentally is also about genome evolution of those strains in vivo, and particularly as it comes to gene gain and loss. Are these strains recombining with other strains in the body? Are they losing genes? Are certain genes under more pressure than others? I think it's such a fascinating area to be at. But again, it gets murky because it doesn't sort of fit into, shall we say, our human love of discrete boxes. Everything is sort of a continuum, so it can be very challenging to do. I think, you know, this idea, especially once we start to understand the mechanisms and to be able to more rapidly characterize them based on the genome sequence, I think that would be very exciting. But the problem with this is you need the experimental work to provide that information. And I think I sort of have this sort of split opinion. You know, originally I was a microbiologist and everything was really, you know, in the lab, wet lab experiments. And then along the way, and I think this also sort of mirrors what happened in the microbiome field, is I got very computational in my approaches. And now today I sort of see a world where it's difficult to have one without the other. All of the, you know, computational or machine learning approaches are propagating information that was often derived computationally. And so I don't truthfully, for me, understand how we can make meaningful progress if we don't have both sides of that equation.
But Jordan, if I was to propose like a thought experiment to you, I take a strain of E. coli, an isolate of E. coli with a single genome. Now, again, that's a consensus genome, I guess, not, you know, or let's say we sequence a single cell and we can see what the genome is like. I would bet I could make probably 1,000 SNPs in that genome that would have no effect whatsoever. Synonymous SNPs, intergenic SNPs, and so on. But I could also probably make 2 or 3 SNPs that might make it antibiotic resistance or knock out its ability to colonize or something. I would call the second one a different strain much quicker than I'd call the first one a different strain, even though genetically they're much closer than to the original. How do we deal with that computationally if we don't have this functional translation?
Yeah, and this is, I think, where you can't replace the actual experimental evidence, right? So ideally for your given organism, these sort of experiments have been done. You've looked at the variation across the strains. You know, you have an idea of what are the important effectors, right? So mutations in an antibiotic resistance gene are more likely to be significant than some, you know, region between genes that's rather cryptic. And I think, again, especially when we start talking about machine learning and deep learning, I think this is really where they can excel, is they can highlight what's most likely to be important, but emphasis on most likely. Then you need something to extend that further to really understand, you know, how those modifications affect the function. And I think especially now as we start to propagate in structural information, understanding how those nucleotide changes might affect structure of the effectors, I think that will start to become more and more powerful. But at the end of the day, I think someone has to test it and confirm these, and then that information goes back into the learning pipeline.
And that's what my question has to do with, is whether or not the test will give you the same result on the same cell line over time. Or could it be that what you're measuring actually also has some other variation that's due to all of the other influences on what the ultimate expression are?
Yeah, it absolutely could over time. And that's the thing, is it's not stable. The organism that you might have in the lab that was derived from whatever strain collection could have picked up meaningful functional changes from the parent. And I think that's why you see in the food industry, you know, there's a handful of players that actually produce everyone's strains from their sort of master collections, and then they ship it off and a big bag gets dumped into the milk. There's a reason for that. Well, there's many reasons, but one of them is having this sort of pristine original representative is important, because with the GG example, the longer it's propagated, the more changes happen. It's difficult to know if they're going to be functionally equivalent. And I think part of that goes back into the sort of question about probiotic efficacy in certain contexts. It's really hard to compare. It's not like a drug. There is a very discrete chemical structure that is being tested in these studies. But when you're comparing something that's derived from the same original genome, but it's not necessarily exactly the same, it's not always a fair comparison. And in some cases, maybe it's going to be important. In other cases, it won't. But it can be very tricky to know. I mean, even within the strain collections, you can on occasion get the wrong organism or have divergence from what the reference organism was when you get it from a strain collection. I think there's a great example of that with some of the gut-brain axis in Rhamnosus JB1, I think is a good example. In fact, I don't think that was even supposed to be Rhamnosus, if memory is correct, in that instance, but it's... I think now that genome sequencing is becoming relatively cheap and quick, we can characterize that. But how we put that information into sort of a functional space, I think that's the next big challenge. And that's a challenge that I think can only be addressed by coupling both the computational and the experimental side of it.
And if I was a probiotic producer, let's say, rather than an academic who can play these thought games and enjoy this conversation, how best should this be managed? Do we really say that, you know, if we sequence the probiotic in someone's product and it has a couple of SNPs from the original one that was used, the original RCT that generated the evidence, we have to dismiss it and throw it out? Or can we say, no, that's within, can we set certain limits where we say, look, if it's within 10 SNPs, we appreciate some of those SNPs may be functionally important, some may not, but we have to live in a real world. Should we be setting some kind of limits?
You know, there probably should be, but those limits that actually worry me more are an intellectual property question. If company A has a strain and company B just propagates it under, shall we say, suboptimal conditions for a month, you know, you could induce that many mutations and it could still retain the function of the original. Is that a discrete strain, you know, from an IP standpoint? I think that's where it starts to get really murky. But I do think the really important part for me is if we understand the mechanism, if we understand it is the production of this outer membrane protein, and then we can look at the mutations that are happening in that outer membrane protein specifically, I think that gives us a great viewpoint. But if we don't really understand how the strains are functioning in the first place, I think that's where there are not necessarily clear answers.
But we're not there. I mean, we don't know mechanism for virtually every probiotic. I'm not sure there's any probiotic where we can say the mechanism is protein A interacting with ligand B and the following health effects. So we're not there yet. In some case, we will get there. But Dan, you want to come in?
Yeah. So Jordan, you described what your lab does is try to understand how the structure and function of the microbiome mediates the influence of diet and perhaps dietary supplements on health outcomes. And that's very noble work. And you had kind of alluded to what's done with small molecule drug research. And, you know, you can look at the structure of the molecule and know that it occupies the receptor appropriately. And then you just described how, well, this particular SNP might have an influence on the outer membrane protein. But really what you're trying to do is even harder, because the microbiome is not just, and it's not just at the molecular level, there's all the interactions among everything else going on in the microbiome. How do you deal with those challenges?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when we think about a microbiome, it's not, you know, most of what we know in, I'd say, you know, the host microbe interaction realm is really derived from pathogens, right? The study of one organism in the host. But in so many of these, shall we say, microbiome related diseases or conditions, it's really multiple microbes working together. And the, shall we say, the function and metabolism of a microbe on its own is quite different from what happens in a community. And so some of this, you know, we can tease out computationally. But one of the things that really excites me in the microbiome field is sort of its next evolution is this idea of having tractable communities to study. And so if we are interested in a condition that's associated with an increase in 15 different organisms, well, let's go out and let's actually study those 15 different organisms, or as best as we can. And so we've been sort of in this space as a proof of concept around C. diff. Or C. difficile. And I think many people would know that C. difficile infection really happens when the competing microbes are knocked out. So we assembled a synthetic community modeling the microbes that are typically lost during colonization. And so that gave us a starting point on which we could start to ask, okay, well, what are the actual functions of this community that are important? And then we can start messing around with the individual members of that synthetic community. In fact, this is a manuscript that should hopefully be submitted in the next week or two. But we'll just say it's not what I think most people think it is. It's something a little bit out of left field. In fact, we can replicate whole human fecal transplant in mice, I should say, with two strains can be just as effective as a fecal transplant if you're trying to enrich for certain metabolic pathways. And so I think that's sort of a great example of studying a tractable community. And to me, it sort of hits this sweet spot between biological relevance, but also reductionist. Because at a certain point, we need to be able to manipulate the microbes, either by making mutations in them or dropping them in and out of communities. And that's just not really feasible from, let's say, a whole human fecal sample. But if we can construct that in the lab and inform it based on, you know, real human data, I think that's a really exciting place to be. And I think looking forward, those sort of approaches are going to come a lot more in sort of the microbiome and the probiotics field, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we had Sean Gibbons on a podcast just relatively recently, and he was computationally doing the same thing, looking at communities that seem to have a niche which C. diff could occupy or are ones which do not, and then calculating how could you change a niche so to make it essentially resistant to C. diff infiltration. Similar kind of work, but computationally. I think the combination of both, doing the actual biology and doing the computational stuff, it's going to be really powerful. Do you think there's anything to be learned right now in, you know, that it's very controversial, of course, people getting their microbiomes sequenced and getting them sent back to them with possible dietary recommendations and things. I know this is a very controversial area right now. What's your take on all of that?
I think in aggregate, I think that's very exciting data. I think at the level of the individual, in the benefit that an individual will see from that, I'm, shall we say, not convinced of the return. So let me answer your question a different way. If my mom asked me if she thought it would be a good investment of her money, I would probably say no. However, that's based on today, not 5 years from now, not 10 years from now. I think it's just a little tricky. And again, I feel like it's one of these questions of how does one get a healthy gut microbiome? And a great answer is have a balanced diet and exercise and make sure you sleep well and all these sort of things, right? And one of the things that sort of excites me about the type of work we're doing right now is really trying to separate the cause and the effect. Because we know that the microbiome is driving a lot of effects on the host, but at the same time, it can also be responding to a lot of cues, both from the host and from the diet. And I think that's one of the challenges in going through microbiome data is I think so much of what we see, probably with autism being a great example, is being driven by diet and behavior, which is not, that has to be separated from the underlying host-microbe interaction.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's so true. It's like seeing the changing microbiome in the elderly or different microbiomes in people on very different diets. It would be absolutely extraordinary if the microbiome wasn't different in those people. It's a different selective environment. So of course it's selecting for different microbes. That's kind of trivial. But again, we come back to the idea of what's the function of that community. You know, are there missing functions that we could augment or supply to that community or not?
Yeah, and that's why I'm such a fan of the notobiotic models. Putting in whatever microbes you want to see how they affect a relevant aspect of host physiology, because that at least is the first pass at separating, was this a cause or an effect of whatever the underlying condition was? But to me, if the only experiments that are being done are fecal transplant from healthy and diseased humans, I think that's really missing the real power of the model, which is to take it a step further. And so to me, I think there was a time where, you know, a microbiome paper was, we sequenced, you know, healthy versus diseased people, we found some set of organisms, and then we did a fecal transplant to a mouse and recovered whatever the phenotype is. I think that will now be the start, and that provides the platform on which you can start to interrogate, okay, well, what were actually the microbes that transferred over, and what are the metabolites that they're producing, and which of these might plausibly actually drive the mechanism? That's, I think, what really excites me.
Yeah, so what I always struggle with as a statistician, Jordan, is when people expect that computationally you can figure out what is doing what when the actual data itself doesn't allow you to identify the contributions from two potential candidates. Like, yeah, you know, it's an underdetermined problem. What I find exciting about your work is that you do seem to use computation to inform what kind of experiments should be done. So is that something that you feel like the field is getting better at figuring out where computationally we really couldn't separate one effect from the other? We need more data. So this is what the next experiment should look like.
Yeah, I think so. And I sort of got a chuckle over this because I think back to like when I first got started in research with like microarrays and maybe a, shall we say, philosophical friction sometimes where, you know, some people might call the high throughput on this technology is hypothesis generating. And there was a time where I thought, oh, that's so ridiculous. That's just being, let's call it pretentious or whatever. And then now circle back, I don't know, 15, a little less years later, I view most of our sequencing in omics data as hypothesis generating, right? And so the challenge for me statistically is figuring out what's my sort of action threshold. It's not having a FDR less than 0.1. It's, okay, we have, here's the set of possibilities. Which of these fits into a mechanism and which one of these can we actually experimentally interrogate? And so it really is, I think, at this point for us, more hypothesis generation than anything else.
Jordan, I think that's a wonderful note to leave it on. We've run out of time. I've really enjoyed talking with you. I was looking forward to it and certainly lived up to what I was looking forward to. So thank you so much. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.